And now, more tips with your host, Rebecca, on lifestyle improvement.
Remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and it's not to be interpreted as medical advice. Hello, and welcome to our program, Lifestyle Improvement. This is your host, Rebecca. Today, we are very pleased to have with us Michael John Carley. Mr. Carley was the founder and first executive director of GRASP, the largest organization comprised of adults on the autism spectrum, and the executive director of ASTEP, the Asperger Syndrome Training and Employment Partnership. Mr. Carley was featured in the documentaries On the Spectrum and Off the Rails. He has been in a wide array of media outlets, from the Washington Post to ABC News, and was one of the two people on the spectrum to address Congress in their first ever hearing on autism. Mr. Carley has been the recipient of many awards and has a column with the Huffington Post, Autism Without Fear. His first book, Asperger's from the Inside Out, a supportive and practical guide for anyone with Asperger's syndrome, was released in April 2008 to wonderful reviews. Until 2001, Mr. Carley was the United Nations representative of Veterans for Peace. He was known primarily for his work in Bosnia and in Iraq as the project director of the internationally acclaimed Iraq Water Project. Prior to 2001, he was also a playwright who enjoyed 15 productions and 10 readings of his plays in New York. His latest book is titled Unemployed on the Autism Spectrum, How to Cope Productively with the Effects of Unemployment and Job Hunt with Confidence. Hello, Mr. Carley, and thank you for joining us today. It is a pleasure to have you.
Rebecca, thank you so much for having me on. And please, it's Michael.
Okay.
Or Michael John.
Fantastic.
Michael for short is fine.
Michael. Okay. Thank you, Michael. On your book, you tell us that your son and you were diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome at the same time. Would you mind giving our listeners a quick overview of what that means to you? And how did your life change when you were diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome as an adult?
To give you a little bit of backdrop, Rebecca, I would say that around the years 1998, when my son was about 5 years old at the time, that he started to display a lot of the telltale signs that I'm sure a lot of your listeners experienced if they had kids on the spectrum. There was a speech delay. There was some motor skills issues. He really wasn't interested in what we would call imaginative play. If he picked up a toy airplane, he wasn't going to pretend that he was the pilot and go vroom, vroom. He was going to spin the wheels and see how it worked. So we would buy dog food in bulk, and he would build these unbelievable pyramids in the hallway with the dog food cans. And so it was like, we knew something was going on. But, you know, at the time, you know, as you had mentioned, I mean, I was a minor league diplomat. So this whole notion of, you know, developmental disabilities was not an arena that we were familiar with whatsoever. As a matter of fact, I probably couldn't have rattled off one developmental disability to you at the time. But through the next couple of years, with things like play therapy and the speech therapy and, you know, the OT and the tests that he was going through, and eventually, you know, somebody mentions this funny sounding word called Asperger syndrome. And, well, to make a long story short, because of the genetic nature of all this stuff, they were starting to look at dear old daddy out of the corner of their eyes. And one thing led to another, and he and I were literally diagnosed about a week apart with Asperger syndrome. As a matter of fact, it was exactly a week apart. For him, we knew that those around him would understand that there was no intent whatsoever to be rude or to hurt anybody's feelings or to, quote unquote, say something inappropriate, which, by the way, is my least favorite word in the English language. And for me, you know, I was 36 years old at the time, and it was, you know, just, you know, this plethora of answers, you know, for all these social situations throughout my life in which I just walked away scratching my head going, what the heck was that all about? And the answers had to do with wiring and not personal character. And I think that at the time, up to that time, I would have an effect on people that could go either one of two ways. I could either be thought of as a person who was rude all the time, didn't really care what others thought all the time. I'm sure you can imagine what that word is. Or there was another camp of people that looked at me and thought, well, Carley is a tell it like it is kind of guy. And I actually didn't think either one of these two factions were any more wrong. But of course, I was going to go hang out with the crowd that thought I was a tell-it-like-it-is guy, because that was just going to be a much easier life for me. So luckily, I was also engaged in work through being a United Nations NGO representative, where if you're operating in these luxurious hotspots like Bosnia and Iraq before we invaded, that nobody cared if you were nice or not as you got through your work. They cared whether or not you got the job done, because there were, you know, it was important for human lives sometimes to get that work done. So nobody cared if you said the inappropriate thing every once in a while or stepped on the boss's toes. It was a perfect line of work for me to be in. And they're not the poker players they think they are at the UN. Their behavioral anthropology is very, very easy to figure out, I promise you. You know, there I was in this unique situation. And the great thing about it that I suddenly realized was, wow, you know, I'll bet there's a lot of parents that when their kids get diagnosed, they really hope that their kids have a chance to have a quote unquote normal life, a rewarding career, a wonderful family, all that sort of stuff. But it's just hope. They don't know Jack. They have no experience to measure it against in order to be able to give them the conviction that their kids with Asperger's syndrome can have a good life. I, on the other hand, had complete proof. I had validation. I knew I had proof that all this was possible. And that put me in a very, very different position than most parents with kids on the spectrum.
Fantastic. That was very well put. Thank you so much. You've been involved in several organizations to support adults on the spectrum. One of them was A-STEP, focusing on corporate diversity and inclusion. How influential was this experience in helping you realize the need that there was for a book like Unemployed on the Spectrum?
Rebecca, it's an excellent question, because it was absolutely priceless. And yet at the same point, after spending those 3 years really immersed in, you know, well, let me backtrack. My work with A-STEP was primarily dealing with just Fortune 1000 companies. So we weren't, you know, looking into the options of, you know, starting your own business for individuals on the spectrum. We weren't looking into small businesses. We weren't looking into employment through nonprofits. It was all, you know, the big corporate culture sort of aspect of things. And to me, this was important because the woman who had started A-STEP, I founded GRASP, but I did not found A-STEP. A-STEP was started by a woman named Marcia Shiner. And Marcia, unlike me, who's been Mr. Nonprofit all his life, Marcia had 25 years of experience in upper management at Credit Suisse and maybe a couple of other entities. And she was somebody who had an adult child on the spectrum who was making the very, very valid point at the time that she and I really bonded over, was that in all of our attempts to improve employment situations within these corporate cultures for individuals with disabilities of any kind, that went to the table as the nonprofit people and tried to sell them on the concepts of social good. Oh, you should do that because it'll help people. Oh, you know, you should do this because it's the right thing to do, or because, you know, you have to, or you'll look bad if you don't, or anything like that. The thing that Marcia and I agreed on was that that isn't what corporate culture wants to hear. Corporate culture wants to hear that you understand what their needs are, that you understand the risks that they're taking by bringing on maybe some people with non-apparent disabilities and trying to intern them or provide them with opportunities. Because when it goes wrong, it's not like the nonprofit world. When it goes wrong in corporate culture, what happens is that the individual business suffers in reputation. They don't get points for trying. You know, in the nonprofit world, we have a phrase where it says, if you don't have a giant failure somewhere on your resume, it means that you're afraid to take risks. So you got to have at least one. That's not true in the corporate world. Another myth I think that sometimes we have about the corporate world is that they want to be leaders. But nobody in corporate America, I would contend, wants to be a leader whatsoever. In corporate America, you want to be second. Let somebody else put their feet in the water. Let somebody else take the risk of losing that PR. Let somebody else be the test case. And then if they succeed, you get right in there and you copycat as quickly as humanly possible. That's their MO. It's always been their MO. I don't know why we still believe in, you know, these slogans that they want to throw at us about leadership, because it just doesn't exist. I mean, you know, there's this concept that the corporate types like to tell us about thought leadership. And usually they're calling themselves that word, you know, when it happens, and they're not thought leaders, they're really not. We spent 3 years, you know, however, in small steps, successfully bridging the relationship between young folks on the spectrum, getting, you know, who are recent college grads, getting them internships into these companies. Now, a lot of it had to do with really just providing those companies with the chance to provide seminars to the youngsters. And while those seminars were really informative to the youngsters, it certainly made, you know, the corporations feel good about themselves because they were doing something charitable by providing that seminar to a group of recent college graduates with Asperger's syndrome. But the hidden motive was really that by making such a union happen, such an event occur, those 1,000 companies got a chance to kick the tires and spend some time with a group of kids with Asperger's syndrome, which otherwise they never would have done. And the comment that we always got afterwards from the Fortune 1000 companies was, wow, I had no idea these guys were so smart.
This is your host, Rebecca, and now we will take a short break, and we will be right back with more ideas on lifestyle improvement.
As a caregiver, you spend your days caring for the needs of someone else, but what are you doing to help yourself? In our Caregiver Survival 101 workshops, we teach you the self-help skills that will empower you to be healthier and more productive. Do you feel tired, overwhelmed, have difficulty sleeping? Do you feel isolated? All these could be signs of caregiver stress. Chronic stress can impact your health adversely and ultimately cause irreversible, unwanted physical problems. Take a step towards your own personal care. A healthy caregiver is a better caregiver. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones to do what is needed to stay healthy today. Go to www.caregiversurvival101.com. That again is www.caregiversurvival101.com, and discover how we can help you help yourself. Caregiversurvival101.com or call 877-957-7387. That again is 877-957-7387.
And the comment that we always got afterwards from the Fortune 1000 companies was, wow, I had no idea these guys were so smart. And so that was really the lure by which we did indeed get the internships. And somebody who myself probably never would have been able to survive in a, you know, a lifelong Fortune 1000 company, you know, it was an incredible education for me. Well, actually, I'll read you, if I may, because in the book, I actually have an example, which I probably should memorize. Here we go. In corporate speak, the translation for cleaned hotel room, you know, like a maid or, you know, somebody who cleans hotel rooms. Utilizing contemporary cleaning methods and products, successfully restored temporary residences of upper management clients to their fullest potential of hygiene, sanitation, and appearance. That's kind of how corporate speak works. And if the individuals learn that, that is something that's really appealing to the corporate types because they're like, this person has put forth effort. It's like anytime you go to another country, if you suck at their language, Rebecca, just stink. So long as you try, so long as they see that you're trying to use the language, that means so much to people. But I also came away from the experience thinking, wow, this is not a life that I think most of our people would want or should want. This is a pretty awful existence for the majority of us. Not all of us. There are people that really want the structure and don't have the creativity to think for themselves about, you know, what professionalism might look like. Go ahead, let them have those lives. Absolutely, that's fine. But we also, I thought, were dodging a giant elephant in the bathtub, and we weren't looking at that. And that was this. Autism is diagnosed as a series of behaviors. Behavioral differences. Corporate culture is all about this word professionalism that has an arguable meaning sometimes. In essence, that professionalism is also about strictly adhering to certain behaviors. So you're talking about an atmosphere which is not behaviorally pluralistic, and yet we're supposed to be fitting in people that are as behaviorally different as can be. I think any individual with autism, Rebecca, understands that you're going to make, no matter how much accommodation that business gives you, you will still be making 10 times the accommodations to fit in with them than they will be for you to fit in. And that sometimes is just going to hurt, you know, a lot of people. And for me, I started to question, you know, here we are and we're really doing all this work trying to get somebody to be able to successfully get through a 30-minute job interview? And why do we think that they're going to have a 30-year career if we're working so hard to get them through a 30-minute job interview for that company?
And I'm so glad you just mentioned that, because that was exactly my next question. Because in your book, you give us the sobering statistics that 75 to 85% of people in the spectrum are unemployed. And one of the biggest things that they have to overcome is starting with the interview process. And in your book, you actually expand on that. So give us just a couple of things that are probably very challenging for someone on the spectrum as far as the job interview is concerned.
Well, I mean, right from the get-go, you have reciprocal conversation, which we already mentioned. There's something to be said for the fact that people on the spectrum would love to all have radio careers, because they could be speaking into the microphone and never have to worry about when it's time for the other person to speak and, you know, whatever. They could just say the salvo of what they want and then stop and then play the music or something like that.
Probably very good at it too, right?
Exactly. It's very funny you mentioned that. I actually was New York Public Radio's backup classical music coach for like 7 years.
Wow.
And I loved it. I loved it. It's just a nice break from the autism world. Uh-huh. So when we're talking about things like making eye contact, you know, hitting the timing buttons right so that you stop talking at the right time, you know, there's silence when the other person enters in. You don't end up interrupting the other person, because we can interrupt people, Rebecca. We're really, really, that's tough for us to, like, you know, stop doing sometimes. And there's the whole, you know, eye contact sometimes revolves around pain in the head, rather than just, you know, the eyes being positioned in a different way. And so sometimes all of that focus on the eye contact, on the reciprocal conversation, it's exhausting to a lot of people. It's a major, major sensory overload. And you also have a population of people that are infinitely more prone to suffering from just general stress and anxiety. And, you know, these are areas in which for that 30 minutes or what have you, that we're supposed to be, you know, stand up individuals, you know, with the shoulders lowered and our body posture okay, and firm handshake and all that sort of jazz. And, you know, it's just, it's a load. It's an absolute load on individuals a lot of the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like you said, however, that is the window to actually move on to the next stage, which is actually getting a job. And when you do get the job, in your book, you break down the many essential things that are required in order to have successful communication in the workplace. What are some of those things? You already mentioned eye contact. What other things do you think are important?
I mean, you know, there's the first off, you have to start to understand that what environment are we in? And if we are talking about the standard, let's say the corporate job, the standard 9-to-5 job, these are difficult because the social rules are never explained, you know, in these jobs, and they're different in each one. You know, we grow up with this lie that we're very, very often told that if you're really good at what you do, you'll always have a job. And that's just not true. In 95% of these jobs, the fact that, you know, if you're struggling to fit in, you're probably not going to last at that job for very, very long. And whether that's right or wrong, you know, is immaterial. It's just we're sending the wrong signals to our kids, whether they're on the spectrum or not, basically. There are, you know, there's all these other aspects, though, that when the spectrum comes in, like you have this thing called the hidden curriculum. And the hidden curriculum is what somebody means when they don't mean what they say or say what they mean. So if we're used to using things like soliloquies or sarcasm or euphemisms, we're sort of going to be knocking individuals out of the on the spectrum out of the conversation, because we're not so good at picking up that stuff. We like text. We like text very, very much. And reading between the lines, or, you know, getting certain types of jokes, that's the sort of stuff that sometimes just goes really, really over our heads. As a matter of fact, there was a study at one point about how individuals would instinctively like to communicate as soon as, when they're babies, they have that ability to retain information. And supposedly most people, if I can get the numbers right, want to communicate 55% through text, 37% through gesture,
and 8% through tone. Whereas individuals on the autism spectrum would prefer to communicate 99% through text. So a lot of, you know, all of that, what we call nonverbal communication, you know, the winks, the facial expressions, the body postures that we use to communicate instead of language, we have to learn to pick that up. Whereas, you know, people that aren't on the autism spectrum instinctively will pick it up along with their peers. And that's part of their developmental process that we just don't be, you know, never kind of get that unless somebody actually teaches us that. And in these corporate jobs where nobody says what they mean or mean what they say, it can be very, very difficult. The boss says to you, kick that upstairs. And you're like, huh, okay. You know, so you take the big pile of paper and you go to the stairwell and you give it a punt, like a football punter, you know, up the stairs. And you're like, I don't know why they asked me to do that, but I'm a good employee. So I did my job. Uh-huh. You got papers all over the stairwell, meanwhile. So that's one of them. Another, you know, another thing, which is, I would say, probably the most complicated thing in the autism world to have to study, which is executive functioning. And executive functioning is very misleading because it has to do with a few things, has to do with emotional regulation. When we get overwhelmed, how do we process it? You know, do we kind of go a little bit of, you know, batty, you know, or are we able to, you know, just take those deep breaths and, you know, get back to square one? But it also has to do with, let's put it this way. It's mistaken sometimes to mean how intelligent you are. Mm-hmm. What it is times how your brain conveys its natural intelligence and how it sort of, so it's almost like your executive functioning is this link between what your natural intelligence is and what you show to the rest of the world. And this can have to do with things like organization. Mm-hmm. What are your organizational skills like? And we can go, the thing about executive functioning, which is interesting about the spectrum, is we can go in both directions. We can be excellent at executive functioning, mm-hmm. or certain aspects of it. And we can be so lousy, it's just not even funny, at executive functioning issues. Multitasking is an executive function capacity as well. And this will play a large role in whether or not you succeed in a lot of these jobs. And the last one of which is just sensory issues. A lot of individuals on the spectrum, it's about not a lot of them, I haven't come across one spectrum individual who doesn't have at least one thing that's a little funky going on with one of their five senses. Mm-hmm. And in the workplace, you could be dealing with sounds that might make somebody with autism go like this. Or, you know, sometimes fluorescent lights give certain individuals headaches. And every once in a while, you're going to have that rare, rare individual in the spectrum who, when he smells a certain brand of floor cleaner, has to go to the ER. And all of these will play a role into that, you know, office environment.
Absolutely. And those are those type of things that, because, like you said, it's just your sensory system reacting, simply you get to cope with it. And if you don't, then it just looks behaviorally inappropriate.
Exactly.
Which you, exactly. And you mentioned that earlier, and because I know that you mentioned a term, and I was going to bring that up later, but might as well bring it up now. You talked about people on the spectrum kind of feeling like behavioral minority. Is that what you meant with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We sometimes look at these words, Rebecca, sometimes of majority and minority. And we automatically associate them as sociological terms, but really they still are math terms at root. And whether or not you're part of any majority, whether it's racial, gender, sexual orientation, economic background, culture, neurological makeup, which is what we're talking about here today, when you're in any one of those majorities, you will automatically assume, because this is just how majorities work, that your way of doing things is the right way. And when you are part of any kind of a minority, any kind of a marginalized population whatsoever, you are always going to doubt the value of your way of doing things. You're going to be prone to that self-doubt. You're not going to have the same confidence that people in the majority will always have. Unfortunately, logic doesn't play into this because that minority's way of doing things might be brilliant. And yet their status as a minority will prevent them from being able to feel that, acknowledge that, and enjoy the confidence that that is the absolute truth, that their way of doing things is genius. Whereas the majority could have the dumbest way of doing things, and they often do, okay? And they will never, ever see this because they're the majority, and because how can it be wrong when so many of us, you know, do it this way?
Remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and is not to be interpreted as medical advice. What if there was a way to help your struggling child perform better academically? Would you pick up the phone and call? Lifestyle Improvement Occupational Therapy Services in Puyallup, Washington supports wellness and optimal educational performance. Instead of just reteaching information, we endeavor to identify the possible root causes for your child's learning difficulties. We offer targeted testing to assist in the creation of an individualized plan and provide you with the brain training tools that can help improve academic performance. Visit our website at www.lifestyleimprovement.com or give us a call today at 877-957-7387, extension 101. That again is 877-957-7387, extension 101. For an initial free phone consultation, Lifestyle Improvement Occupational Therapy. We're ready to partner with parents and to help your child succeed. Mr. Carley was the founder and first executive director of GRASP, the largest organization comprised of adults on the autism spectrum, and the executive director of ASTEP, the Asperger Syndrome Training and Employment Partnership. Mr. Carley was featured in the documentaries On the Spectrum and Off the Rails. He has been in a wide array of media outlets, from the Washington Post to ABC News, and was one of the two people on the spectrum to address Congress in their first ever hearing on autism.
Don't forget to join us again next Sunday morning from 7:30 to 8 for more tips on lifestyle improvement.